Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov, in a translation by Diana Bergen and Catherine Tiernan O'Connor, narrated by George Guidel and directed by Greta Byram. This book is copyrighted 1995 by Ardis Publishers. This recording is copyrighted 2006 by Recorded Books. An audacious revision of the stories of Faust and Pontius Pilate, The Master and Margarita is recognized as one of the essential classics of modern Russian literature. The novel's vision of Soviet life in the 1930s is so ferociously accurate that it could not be published during its author's lifetime and appeared only in a censored edition in the 1960s. Its truths are so enduring that its language has become part of common, everyday Russian speech. And now, The Master and Margarita.
Part 1. From Goethe's Faust. And so who are you, after all? I am part of the power which forever wills evil and forever works good. Chapter 1. Never talk to strangers. One hot spring evening, just as the sun was going down, two men appeared at Patriarch's Ponds. One of them, 40-ish, wearing a gray summer suit, was short, dark-haired, bald on top, paunchy, and held his proper fedora in his hand. Black horn-rimmed glasses of supernatural proportions adorned his well-shaven face. The other one, a broad-shouldered, reddish-haired, shaggy young man with a checked cap cocked on the back of his head, was wearing a cowboy shirt, crumpled white trousers, and black sneakers. The first man was none other than Mikhail Alexandrovich Berlioz, editor of a literary magazine and chairman of the board of one of Moscow's largest literary associations, known by its acronym, Masolit. And his young companion was the poet Ivan Nikolaevich Ponyryov, who wrote under the pen name Bezdomny. After reaching the shade of the newly budding linden trees, the writers made a beeline for the colorfully painted refreshment stand bearing the sign Beer and Cold Drinks. And here it is worth noting the first strange thing about that terrible May evening. Absolutely no one was to be seen, not only by the refreshment stand, but all along the tree-lined path that ran parallel to Malaya Bronaya Street. At a time when no one, it seemed, had the strength to breathe, when the sun had left Moscow scorched to a crisp and was collapsing in a dry haze somewhere behind the Sadovaya Ring, no one came out to walk under the lindens or to sit down on a bench, and the path was deserted.
"Give me some narzan water," said Berlioz. "There isn't any," replied the woman at the refreshment stand, taking umbrage for some reason.
"Got any beer?" inquired Bezdomny in a hoarse voice.
"The beer will be delivered later," the woman answered. "So what have you got?" asked Berlioz. "Apricot juice, only it's warm," said the woman. "Well, give us that, then."
The apricot juice generated an abundance of yellow foam, and the air started smelling like a barber shop. The writers drank it down and immediately began hiccuping, paid their money, and went over and sat down on a bench facing the pond with their backs to Bronaya Street. Here, the second strange thing happened, which affected Berlioz alone. He suddenly stopped hiccuping, his heart pounded, and stopped beating for a second, then started up again. but with a blunt needle lodged inside it. Besides that, Berlioz was seized with a groundless fear so intense that he wanted to run away from Patriarch's Ponds that very minute without looking back. Berlioz looked around miserably, not knowing what had frightened him. He turned pale, wiped his forehead with a handkerchief, and thought, "What's wrong with me? This has never happened before. My heart's playing tricks on me. I'm overtired. Maybe it's time to throw everything to the devil and go off to Kislovodsk." And then the hot air congealed in front of him, and out of it materialized a transparent man of most bizarre appearance. A small head with a jockey cap, a skimpy little checked jacket that was made out of air. The man was 7 feet tall, but very narrow in the shoulders, incredibly thin, and his face, please note, had a jeering look about it. Berlioz's life was so arranged that he was unaccustomed to unusual happenings. He turned even paler, opened his eyes wide, and, in a state of confusion, thought, "This can't be." But alas, it was. And the tall, transparent man swayed from left to right in front of him without touching the ground. At this point, Berlioz was so overcome with terror that he shut his eyes. And when he opened them, he saw that it was all over. The mirage had evaporated, the man in checks had vanished, and the blunt needle had dislodged itself from his heart.
"What the devil?" exclaimed the editor. "You know, Ivan, I think I almost had a sunstroke just then. Maybe even something like a hallucination."
He tried to smile, but alarm still flickered in his eyes, and his hands were shaking. Gradually, however, he calmed down, fanned himself with his handkerchief, managed a fairly cheerful, "Well, and resumed the conversation that had been interrupted by the apricot juice. This conversation, as was learned subsequently, was about Jesus Christ. The fact is that the editor had commissioned the poet to write a long anti-religious poem for the next issue of his journal. Ivan Nikolaevich had composed the poem, and in a very short period of time at that. But unfortunately, it had not met with the editor's approval. Bezdomnya had painted the central character of his poem, that is, Jesus, in very dark colors. And yet, in the editor's opinion, the whole poem had to be rewritten. And so now the editor was giving the poet a kind of lecture on Jesus in order to point out to him his basic error. It is hard to say what had ultimately led Ivan Nikolaevich astray. The descriptive power of his pen, or his complete ignorance of his subject matter. But the Jesus whom he portrayed emerged as a, well, totally lifelike figure. A Jesus who had once existed, although, admittedly, a Jesus provided with all sorts of negative traits. Thus, Berlioz wanted to prove to the poet that the important thing was not what kind of man Jesus was, good or bad, but rather that Jesus, as an individual, had never existed on earth at all, and that all the stories about him were mere fabrications, myths of the most standard kind. It should be noted that the editor was a well-read man, and in his speech he made very clever allusions to ancient historians such as the famous Philo of Alexandria and the brilliantly educated Flavius Josephus, neither of whom had said a word about the existence of Jesus. With a display of solid erudition, Mikhail Alexandrovich also informed the poet, in passing, that the passage in Book 15, Chapter 44, of Tacitus's famous annals, where mention is made of Jesus' execution, is nothing but a later fraudulent interpolation. The poet, for whom everything the editor said was a novelty, stared at Mikhail Alexandrovich with his sharp green eyes and listened to him attentively, hiccuping only occasionally and cursing the apricot juice under his breath.
There is not a single Eastern religion, Berlioz was saying, where an Immaculate Virgin does not, as a matter of course, bring forth a god into the world. And the Christians, displaying no originality whatsoever, followed the same pattern when they created their Jesus, who, in fact, never existed at all. That's where you have to put your main emphasis.
Berlioz's high tenor resounded along the deserted path. And as Mikhail Alexandrovich ventured into that maze, which only a highly educated man can explore without risking his neck, the poet learned more and more interesting and useful things about the Egyptian Osiris, the kind god and son of heaven and earth, and about the Phoenician god Tammuz, and about Marduk, and even about the lesser-known terrible god Huitzilopochtli, who had once been venerated by the Aztecs in Mexico. And just as Mikhail Alexandrovich was telling the poet how the Aztecs had modeled figures of Huitzilopochtli out of dough, the first man appeared on the pathway. Afterward, when, frankly speaking, it was already too late, various agencies filed reports describing this man. If one compares them, one cannot help but be astonished. For example, one says that he was short, had gold teeth and was lame in his right foot. Another says that he was hugely tall, had platinum crowns and was lame in his left foot. Yet a third notes laconically that he had no distinguishing characteristics whatsoever. We should add that all of the reports were worthless. To begin with, the subject was lame in neither foot, and he was neither short nor hugely tall, but simply tall. As for his teeth, the left ones had platinum crowns, the right, gold. He was dressed in an expensive gray suit and wore foreign-made shoes of the same color. A gray beret was cocked rakishly over his ear, and under his arm he carried a walking stick with a black knob shaped like a poodle's head. He looked to be a little over 40, slightly crooked mouth, smooth-shaven, dark brown hair, right eye black, left, for some reason, green. Black eyebrows, but one was higher than the other. In a word, a foreigner. As he passed the bench where the editor and poet were sitting, the foreigner looked at them out of the corner of his eye, stopped, and suddenly sat down on a neighboring bench 2 feet away.
A German, thought Berlioz.
An Englishman, thought Bezdomny. I bet he's hot with those gloves on. The foreigner looked around at the tall buildings that formed a square border around the pond, thus making it obvious that he was seeing the place for the first time and that it interested him. He rested his gaze on the upper stories of the buildings and on the window pane's blinding reflection of the broken sun that was departing from Mikhail Alexandrovich forever. Then he lowered his gaze to where the window panes were turning dark in the dusk, gave a condescending smile, narrowed his eyes, placed his hands on the knob of his walking stick, and rested his chin on his hands.
"Some things, Ivan, you described very well and satirically," Berlioz was saying. "For example, the birth of Jesus, the Son of God. But the fact is that a whole host of sons of God were born even before Jesus, like, say, the Phoenician Adonis, the Phrygian Attis, the Persian Mithras. But, in short, none of them, including Jesus, were ever born or existed, and so, instead of describing his birth or, say, the coming of the Magi, you should describe the nonsense that was said about all this. Otherwise, your account seems to suggest that he really was born."
Bezdomny held his breath in an effort to stop the hiccups that were tormenting him, which only made them louder and more excruciating, at which point Berlioz stopped talking because the foreigner suddenly got up and came over to them. They looked up at him in amazement.
"Please excuse me," he said, speaking correctly but with a foreign accent, "for presuming to speak to you without an introduction, but the subject of your learned discussion is so interesting that—"
Here he politely removed his beret, and the friends had no choice but to raise themselves slightly and bow in response.
No, more likely he's French, thought Berlioz.
A Pole? Thought Bezdomny. It should be added that the poet found the foreigner loathsome from the moment he opened his mouth, whereas Berlioz rather liked him, or, if not liked him, then, how shall we say it, at least took an interest in him. "May I join you?" asked the foreigner politely, and the friends moved apart involuntarily. The foreigner deftly seated himself between them and immediately joined their conversation.
"Was I mistaken when I heard you say that Jesus never existed on earth?" asked the foreigner, focusing his left green eye on Berlioz.
"No, you are not mistaken," Berlioz replied courteously. "That's exactly what I said."
"Ah, how interesting," exclaimed the foreigner.
"What the devil is he after?" thought Bezdomny with a scowl.
"And do you agree with your friend?" queried the stranger, turning to Bezdomny on his right.
100%,
confirmed Bezdomny, who loved pretentious, figurative expressions.
"Astonishing!" exclaimed the uninvited discussant,
and then, looking around furtively for some reason, and muffling his already low voice, he said,
"Excuse my persistence, but did I understand you to say that you don't believe in God either?"
He made his eyes pop in mock fright and added,
"I swear I won't tell anyone."
"That's right, we don't believe in God,"
answered Berlioz with a faint smile at the tourist's fear.
"But we can talk about it freely and openly."
The foreigner leaned back on the bench and practically squealed with curiosity as he asked,
"You mean you're atheists?"
"Yes, we are,"
answered Berlioz with a smile, while Bezdomny thought in irritation, "He's sticking to us like glue, the foreign pest."
"Oh, how delightful," cried the amazed foreigner, turning to look first at one writer and then the other.
"In our country, atheism comes as no surprise to anyone," said Berlioz in a polite and diplomatic way. "The majority of our population made a conscious decision long ago not to believe the fairy tales about God."
Here the foreigner made the following move. He got up, pressed the astonished editor's hand, and uttered these words,
"Allow me to thank you with all my heart."
"What are you thanking him for?" queried Bezdomny, blinking.
"For very important information that I, as a traveller, find extraordinarily interesting," explained the eccentric from abroad, raising his finger in a meaningful way.
The important information had apparently made a really strong impression on the traveller, since he anxiously scanned the surrounding buildings as if in fear of spotting an atheist in every window.
"No, he's not English," thought Berlioz,
while Bezdomny wondered, "Where in hell did he learn to speak Russian like that? That's what I'd like to know." And he scowled again.
"But may I ask," resumed the guest from abroad after a moment's troubled reflection, "what do you make of the proofs of God's existence, of which, as you know, there are 5?
"Alas," answered Berlioz regretfully, "all of those proofs are worthless, and mankind has long since consigned them to oblivion. Surely you would agree that reason dictates that there can be no proof of God's existence."
"Bravo!" exclaimed the foreigner. "Bravo! You've said just what that restless old sage Emmanuel said about this very same subject. But here's the rub. He completely demolished all 5 proofs, and then, in a seeming display of self-mockery, he constructed a 6th proof, all his own."
"Kant's proof," retorted the educated editor with a faint smile, "is also unconvincing. No wonder Schiller said that only slaves could be satisfied with Kant's arguments on this subject, while Strauss simply laughed at his proof."
As Berlioz was speaking, he thought,
"But who is he, anyway, and how come his Russian is so good? This guy Kant ought to get 3 years in Solovki for proofs like that."
blurted out Ivan Nikolaevich, completely unexpectedly.
"Ivan!"
whispered Berlioz in consternation. But the suggestion that Kant be sent to Solovki not only failed to shock the foreigner, it positively delighted him.
"Precisely so, precisely so," he cried, and his green left eye, which was focused on Berlioz, sparkled. "That's the very place for him, as I told him that time at breakfast. As you please, Professor, but you've contrived something totally absurd. True, it may be clever, but it's totally incomprehensible. People will laugh at you."
Berlioz's eyes popped.
"At breakfast? With Kant? What kind of nonsense is this?" he thought.
"However," continued the foreigner, unflustered by Berlioz's astonishment, and turning to the poet, "he can't be sent to Solovki for the simple reason that for more than 100 years now he's been somewhere far more remote than Solovki, and there's no way of getting him out of there, I assure you."
"Too bad," responded the poet, bully. "I couldn't agree more," concurred the stranger, his eye agleam, and he continued, "but this is what disturbs me. If there is no God, then the question is, who is in control of man's life and the whole order of things on earth?"
"Man himself is in control," was Bezdomny's quick and angry reply to what was admittedly a not very clear question.
"I'm sorry," replied the stranger in a soft voice, "but in order to be in control, you have to have a definite plan for at least a reasonable period of time. So, how, may I ask, can man be in control if he can't even draw up a plan for a ridiculously short period of time, say 1,000 years, and is, moreover, unable to ensure his own safety for even the next day? And indeed," here the stranger turned to Berlioz, "suppose you were to start controlling others and yourself, and just as you developed a taste for it, so to speak, you suddenly went and, well, got lung cancer." At which point the foreigner chuckled merrily, as if the thought of lung cancer brought him pleasure.
"Yes, cancer," he repeated, narrowing his eyes like a cat as he savored the sonorous word. "And there goes your control. No one's fate is of any interest to you except your own. Your relatives start lying to you. You, sensing that something is wrong, run to learned physicians, then to quacks, and maybe even to fortune tellers in the end. And going to any of them is pointless, as you well know. And it all ends tragically. That same fellow who not so long ago supposed that he was in control of something ends up lying stiff in a wooden box. And those present, realizing that he is no longer good for anything, cremate him in an oven. Why, even worse things can happen. A fellow will have just decided to make a trip to Kislovodsk." Here, the foreigner narrowed his eyes at Berlioz. "A trivial matter, it would seem, but he can't even accomplish that because, for some unknown reason, he goes and slips and falls under a streetcar. Would you really say that that's an example of his control over himself? Wouldn't it be more correct to say that someone other than himself is in control?" And at this point, the stranger laughed, a strange sort of laugh. Berlioz listened with rapt attention to the unpleasant story about cancer and the streetcar, and uneasy thoughts began to trouble him.
"He's no foreigner. He's no foreigner," he thought. "He's a real oddball. But who exactly is he?"
"You'd like a smoke, wouldn't you?" said the stranger, unexpectedly turning to Bezdomny. "Which brand do you prefer?"
"You have assorted brands, is that it?" glumly inquired the poet, who had run out of cigarettes.
"Which do you prefer?" repeated the stranger.
Well, how about our brand? Was Bezdomny's sneering reply. The stranger immediately pulled a cigarette case out of his pocket and offered it to Bezdomny. Our brand. Both the editor and the poet were astonished, not so much by the fact that the case did contain our brand, but rather by the cigarette case itself. It was enormous, made of pure gold, and as it was being opened, the blue and white fire of a diamond triangle sparkled on its cover. The writers had different thoughts at this point. Berlioz thought, no, he's definitely a foreigner. And Bezdomny thought, ah, to hell with him. Both the poet and the owner of the cigarette case lit up, but Berlioz, a non-smoker, declined. That's how I'll refute his argument, decided Berlioz. Yes, of course, man is mortal, no one would deny that, but the point is that... But before he could utter these words, the foreigner went on to say, yes, man is mortal, but that isn't so bad. What's bad is that sometimes he's unexpectedly mortal. That's the rub. And in general, he can't even say in the morning what he'll be doing that very same night. What an absurd way of posing the question, thought Berlioz, and retorted, well, that's a bit of an exaggeration. I know more or less precisely what I'll be doing this evening. It goes without saying, of course, that if a brick were to fall on my head on Bronaya Street... The brick is neither here nor there, interrupted the stranger in an imposing fashion. It never merely falls on someone's head from out of nowhere. In your case, I can assure you that a brick poses no threat whatsoever. You will die another kind of death. And you know just what that will be, queried Berlioz with perfectly understandable irony, letting himself be drawn into a truly absurd conversation. And you'll tell me what that is? Gladly, replied the stranger. He took Berlioz's measure as if intending to make him a suit, and muttered something through his teeth that sounded like, 1, 2, Mercury in the second house, the moon has set, 6, misfortune, evening, 7. Then he announced loudly and joyously, your head will be cut off. Bezdomny glared fiercely and malevolently at the impertinent stranger, and Berlioz asked with a crooked smile on his face, by whom, namely, enemies? Interventionists? No, replied his interlocutor, by a Russian woman, a member of the Komsomol. Hmm, grunted Berlioz, irritated by the stranger's little joke. Well, excuse me, but that's highly unlikely. No, please excuse me, replied the foreigner, but that's how it is. By the way, I wanted to ask you, what will you be doing this evening if it's not a secret? It's not. First, I'm going home to my place on Sadovaya, and then at 10 there's a meeting at Masolit, which I'll be chairing. No, that can't be, firmly protested the foreigner. And why is that? Because, replied the foreigner, narrowing his eyes and looking up at the sky where the blackbirds were circling noiselessly in anticipation of the evening coolness. Anushka has already bought this sunflower oil and not just bought it, but spilled it as well. So the meeting won't take place. At this point, as one might expect, silence fell under the lindens.
Excuse me, resumed Berlioz after a pause, looking at the nonsense-spouting foreigner. But what's sunflower oil got to do with it? And who is this Anushka?
Here's what the sunflower oil has to do with it, interjected Bezdomny suddenly, evidently deciding to declare war on their uninvited interlocutor. You haven't by any chance spent some time in a mental hospital, have you?
Ivan,
softly exclaimed Mikhail Alexandrovich. But the foreigner was not the least bit insulted, and he burst out with a hearty laugh. I have indeed, and more than once, he exclaimed, laughing, his unsmiling eye still focused on the poet. "And where haven't I been? I'm only sorry I never managed to ask the professor what schizophrenia is, so you'll have to ask him yourself, Ivan Nikolaevich."
"How do you know my name?"
"Goodness, Ivan Nikolaevich, who doesn't know you?"
At which point the foreigner pulled the previous day's literary gazette out of his pocket, and Ivan Nikolaevich saw a picture of himself on the front page and, underneath it, some of his poems. But the evidence of his fame and popularity, which had so delighted the poet the day before, now gave him no pleasure whatsoever.
"Excuse me," he said, and his face darkened, "but could you wait a minute? I'd like to have a word with my colleague."
"Oh, by all means," exclaimed the stranger. "It's so pleasant here under the lindens, and besides, I'm in no hurry to go anywhere."
"Look here, Misha," whispered the poet after taking Berlioz aside. "He isn't a tourist at all, but a spy. He's a Russian emigre who's managed to get back here. Ask to see his papers or he'll get away."
"You really think so?"
whispered Berlioz anxiously, thinking to himself, "He's probably right." "Mark my words," hissed the poet in his ear. "He's playing the fool in order to pump us for information. You heard how well he speaks Russian," said the poet, looking at the stranger out of the corner of his eye to make sure he did not run off. "Come on, let's grab him or he'll get away." The poet took Berlioz by the arm and led him over to the bench. The stranger was no longer seated on the bench, but was standing near it, holding a small booklet bound in dark gray, a thick envelope made of good quality paper, and a visiting card.
"Excuse me," he said with importance, looking intently at the two men of letters, "but in the heat of our discussion I neglected to introduce myself. Here is my card, my passport, and my invitation to come to Moscow as a consultant."
They became embarrassed.
"Damn, he's heard everything," thought Berlioz, and he made a polite gesture to show that a presentation of papers was not necessary.
When the foreigner thrust them at the editor, the poet managed to make out the word "professor" written on the card in foreign letters and also the first letter of his surname, the double V, a W.
Meanwhile, the editor mumbled and embarrassed, "I'm very pleased to meet you."
And the foreigner shoved the documents into his pocket. Thus, relations between them were restored, and all three again sat down on the bench.
"So you've been invited here as a consultant, professor?"
asked Berlioz.
"Yes, that's right."
"Are you a German?"
queried Bezdomny.
"Who, me?" replied the professor, and suddenly grew pensive. "Yes, I suppose I'm a German," he said.
"Your Russian is first rate," observed Bezdomny.
"Oh, in general, I'm a polyglot and know a great many languages," answered the professor.
"And what is your field?" inquired Berlioz.
"I'm a specialist in black magic."
"Well, I'll be,"
flashed through Mikhail Alexandrovich's head.
And is it in that capacity that you've been invited here?" stammered Berlioz.
"Yes, it is,"
affirmed the professor, and he went on to explain.
"Some authentic manuscripts of the 10th century master of black magic, Gerbert of Aurillac, have been discovered here in your state library, and I've been asked to examine them. I'm the only person in the whole world who's qualified to do so."
"Ah, so you're a historian then?"
asked Berlioz with great respect and relief.
"Yes, I'm a historian," confirmed the scholar, and added, apropos of nothing, "this evening some interesting history will take place at Patriarch's Ponds."
And again, both the editor and the poet were completely dumbfounded. The professor motioned to both of them to come closer, and when they had, he whispered,
"Keep in mind that Jesus did exist."
"You know, professor," answered Berlioz with a forced smile, "we respect your great knowledge, but we happen to have a different point of view regarding that issue."
"No points of view are necessary," replied the strange professor.
He simply existed. And that's all there is to it.
But surely some proof is required, began Berlioz.
No. No proof is required, answered the professor. He began to speak softly, and as he did, his accent somehow disappeared. It's all very simple. Early in the morning, on the 14th day of the spring month of Nisan, wearing a white cloak with a blood-red lining, and shuffling with his cavalryman's gait, Chapter 2 Pontius Pilate. Early in the morning, on the 14th day of the spring month of Nisan, wearing a white cloak with a blood-red lining and shuffling with his cavalryman's gait into the roofed colonnade that connected the two wings of the palace of Herod the Great, walked the procurator of Judea, Pontius Pilate. More than anything in the world, the procurator loathed the smell of rose oil, and everything now pointed to a bad day, since that smell had been pursuing him since dawn. It seemed to the procurator that the palms and cypresses in the garden were emitting a rose scent, and that even the smell of leather gear and sweat coming from the escort contained a hellish trace of roses. From the outbuildings at the rear of the palace, the quarters of the first cohort of the 12th Lightning Legion, which had accompanied the procurator to Yerushalayim, smoke was drifting across the upper terrace of the garden into the colonnade. And this acrid smoke, which signaled that the century's cooks had begun to prepare dinner, contained an admixture of that same oily rose scent.
Oh, gods! Gods, why are you punishing me? Yes, there's no doubt about it. It's back again, that horrible, relentless affliction. A hemicrania that shoots pain through half my head. There's no remedy for it. No relief. I'll try not to move my head.
An armchair had been set out for him on the mosaic floor near the fountain, and the procurator sat down in it and, without looking at anyone, put his hand out sideways. His secretary respectfully handed him a piece of parchment. Unable to hold back a grimace of pain, the procurator gave a fleeting sidelong glance at what was written on the parchment, handed it back to the secretary, and said with difficulty, "The accused is from Galilee. Was the case sent to the Tetrarch?"
"Yes, procurator," replied the secretary.
"And what did he do?"
"He refused to give a judgment in the case, and sent the death sentence pronounced by the Sanhedrin to you for confirmation," explained the secretary.
The procurator's cheek twitched, and he said quietly,
"Bring in the accused."
Two legionaries immediately left the garden terrace, proceeded through the colonnade, and came out onto the balcony, escorting a man of about 27, whom they stood before the procurator's chair. The man was dressed in a light blue chiton that was old and torn. He had a white bandage on his head that was held in place by a leather thong tied around his forehead, and his hands were tied behind his back. There was a large bruise under the man's left eye and a cut with dried blood on it in the corner of his mouth. The prisoner looked with anxious curiosity at the procurator. The procurator was silent for a moment. Then he said quietly, in Aramaic,
"So it was you who incited the people to destroy the temple of Yerushalayim."
The procurator sat stone-like, moving his lips only slightly as he spoke. The procurator was stone-like because he was afraid to move his head, which was seared by hellish pain. The man whose hands were bound took a few steps forward and began to speak.
"My good man, believe me."
But the procurator, perfectly still as before, and without raising his voice, interrupted him on the spot.
"Is it me you are calling a good man? You're mistaken. Word has it in Yerushalayim that I am a savage monster, and that is absolutely true."
In the same monotone, he added,
"Bring Centurion Ratkiller to me."
It seemed to everyone that it became dark on the balcony when Mark the Centurion, nicknamed Ratkiller, who commanded the first century, came and stood before the procurator. Ratkiller was a head taller than the tallest soldier in the legion, and so broad in the shoulders that he blocked out the sun, which was still low in the sky. The procurator addressed the centurion in Latin. "The criminal calls me good man. Take him away for a moment and explain to him how he should address me. But don't maim him." Everyone except the motionless procurator stared at Mark Ratkiller as he gestured to the prisoner to follow him. Because of his height, Ratkiller was usually stared at by everyone wherever he went, and those seeing him for the first time also stared because of his disfigured face. His nose had once been smashed by a German club. Mark's heavy boots stamped in the mosaic. The bound man followed him out noiselessly. Complete silence ensued in the colonnade, and one could hear the doves cooing on the garden terrace by the balcony and the water in the fountain singing a pleasant and intricate tune. The procurator felt the urge to get up, put his temple under the water, and freeze in that position, but he knew that even that would not help him. After leading the prisoner through the colonnade and out into the garden, Ratkiller took a whip from the hands of a legionary standing at the foot of a bronze statue and struck the prisoner a mild blow across the shoulders. The centurion's stroke was casual and light, but the bound man sank to the ground instantly as if his legs had been knocked out from under him. He gasped for breath, the color left his face, and his eyes glazed over. With just his left hand, Mark lifted the fallen man into the air lightly as if he were an empty sack, stood him on his feet, and began speaking in a nasal voice, mispronouncing the Aramaic words.
"Address the Roman procurator as hegemon. Do not use other words. Stand at attention. Have you understood me, or do I have to hit you again?"
The prisoner swayed on his feet but got control of himself. His color returned. He caught his breath and answered hoarsely, "I understand you. Don't beat me." A minute later, he was again standing before the procurator. A flat, sick-sounding voice was heard.
"Name?"
"Mine?" The prisoner responded quickly, demonstrating with all his being his readiness to answer sensibly and not to provoke more anger. The procurator said softly,
"Mine, I know. Do not pretend to be more stupid than you are. Yours."
"Yeshua," the prisoner replied hurriedly.
"Is there a surname?"
"Hanotzri."
"Where are you from?"
"The city of Gamala," answered the prisoner, indicating with a toss of his head that somewhere far away, off to his right, in the north, was the city of Gamala.
"Who are you by birth?"
"I don't know exactly," the prisoner replied readily. "I don't remember my parents. I've been told that my father was a Syrian."
"Where is your permanent residence?"
"I have none," answered the prisoner shyly. "I travel from town to town."
"That can be expressed more succinctly in one word. Vagrant," said the procurator.
Then he asked,
"Do you have any family?"
"None. I am alone in the world."
"Are you literate?"
"Yes."
"Do you know any language besides Aramaic?"
"Yes, Greek."
One swollen lid was raised, and an eye glazed by suffering stared at the prisoner. The other eye remained closed.
Pilate began speaking in Greek.
"So you intended to destroy the temple building and were inciting the people to do this?"
Here the prisoner again became animated. The fear disappeared from his eyes, and he began in Greek. The prisoner's eyes flashed with horror at having again almost said the wrong thing. "Never in my life, hegemon, have I intended to destroy the temple, nor have I ever tried to instigate such a senseless action." A look of surprise crossed the face of the secretary, who was bent over a low table, writing down the testimony. He raised his head, but then immediately lowered it to the parchment. All kinds of different people flock into the city for the holiday. Among them are magi, astrologers, soothsayers, and murderers, said the procurator in a monotone, and liars as well. You, for example. It is plainly written, he incited the people to destroy the temple. People have testified to that. Those good people, began the prisoner, and after hastily adding, Hegemon, he continued, are ignorant and have muddled what I said. In fact, I'm beginning to fear that this confusion will go on for a long time, and all because he writes down what I said incorrectly. Silence ensued. Now both pained eyes gazed at the prisoner seriously. I will tell you again, but for the last time, stop pretending to be crazy, villain, said Pilate in a soft monotone. Not much has been recorded against you, but it is enough to hang you. No, no, Hegemon, said the prisoner, straining every nerve in his desire to be convincing. There's someone who follows me around everywhere, always writing on a goatskin parchment. And once I happened to see the parchment and was aghast. Absolutely nothing that was written there did I ever say. I begged him, for God's sake, burn your parchment. But he snatched it out of my hands and ran away. Who is he? Asked Pilate, distastefully, touching his hand to his temple. Levi Matvei, the prisoner explained willingly. He was a tax collector, and I first met him on a road in Bethphage, at the place where the fig orchard juts out at an angle, and I struck up a conversation with him. At first, he treated me with hostility, and even insulted me. That is, he thought he was insulting me by calling me a dog. Here the prisoner laughed. I personally have no bad feelings about dogs that would cause me to take offense at the name. The secretary stopped writing and cast a furtive, surprised glance not at the prisoner, but at the procurator. However, after he heard me out, he began to soften, continued Yeshua. And finally, he threw his money down on the road and said that he'd come traveling with me. Pilate laughed with one side of his mouth, baring his yellow teeth. Turning his whole body to the secretary, he said, O city of Yerushalayim, what tales it can tell. Did you hear that? A tax collector who throws his money on the road. Not knowing how to respond to that, the secretary deemed it obligatory to smile as Pilate had. But he said that money had become hateful to him, said Yeshua in explanation of Levi Matvei's strange behavior, and then he added, Since then, he has been my traveling companion. His teeth still bared. The procurator glanced first at the prisoner, and then at the sun which was rising steadily over the equestrian statues of the hippodrome located far below to the right. And suddenly, as an agonizing wave of nausea swept over him, the procurator realized that the simplest way to get this strange miscreant off his balcony was with two words. Hang him. Get rid of the escort, too. Leave the colonnade. Go inside the palace. Order the room to be darkened. Collapse on the bed. Ask for some cold water. Call piteously for the dog Banga and complain to him about his hemicrania. Suddenly, the thought of poison flashed seductively through the procurator's aching head. He looked at the prisoner with lusterless eyes and was silent for a while, trying desperately to recall why this prisoner, with a face disfigured by beatings, was standing before him in Yerushalayim's pitiless morning sun, and what other pointless questions had to be addressed to him.
Levi Matvei, did you say?
The sick man asked in a hoarse voice and shut his eyes. Yes, Levi Matvei, came the high voice that was tormenting him.
But still, what was it that you said about the temple to the crowd in the marketplace?
The voice of the man answering seemed to pierce the side of Pilate's forehead. Inexpressibly tormenting, that voice said, I said, Hegemon, that the temple of the old faith will fall, and that a new temple of truth will be created.
I said it that way to make it easier to understand.
Why did you, a vagrant, stir up the crowds in the marketplace by talking about truth, when you have no conception of what it is? What is truth?
And here the procurator thought,
oh my gods, I am questioning about something irrelevant to the case. My brain isn't working anymore.
And again he had a vision of a cup of dark liquid.
Poison. Give me poison.
And again he heard the voice. The truth is, first of all, that your head aches, so badly, in fact, that you're having faint-hearted thoughts about death. Not only are you too weak to talk to me, but you're even having trouble looking at me. That I, at this moment, am your unwilling executioner upsets me. You can't think about anything, and the only thing you want is to call your dog, the only creature, it seems, to whom you are attached. But your sufferings will soon end, and your headache will pass. The secretary looked goggle-eyed at the prisoner and stopped writing in the middle of a word. Pilate raised his martyred eyes to the prisoner and saw that the sun was already high above the hippodrome, that one ray had penetrated the colonnade and was creeping toward Yeshua's tattered sandals, and that he was trying to step out of the sun. The procurator then got up from his chair and pressed his head with his hands, a look of horror appearing on his yellowish, clean-shaven face. But he immediately suppressed it with an effort of will and again lowered himself into the chair. Meanwhile, the prisoner went on talking, but the secretary no longer wrote any of it down. He just craned his neck like a goose, not wanting to miss a single word. "Well, then, it's all over," said the prisoner, looking kindly at Pilate. "And I'm very glad that it is. I would advise you, Hegemon, to leave the palace for a short while and take a stroll somewhere in the vicinity, perhaps in the gardens on Mount Ilion. There will be a thunderstorm." The prisoner turned and squinted his eyes at the sun. "Later on, towards evening. The walk would do you a lot of good, and I would be happy to accompany you. Some new ideas have occurred to me, which may, I think, be of interest to you, and I would be especially happy to share them with you, since you strike me as being a very intelligent man." The secretary turned deathly pale and dropped the scroll on the floor. "The trouble is," continued the bound man, whom no one was stopping, "that you are too isolated and have lost all faith in people. After all, you will agree, one shouldn't lavish all one's attention on a dog. Your life is impoverished, Hegemon." And here the speaker allowed himself a smile. The secretary now had only one thought: whether or not to believe his own ears. There was no other choice but to believe. Then he'd try to imagine in exactly what fanciful way the procurator would express his anger at the prisoner's unprecedented insolence. But the secretary could not imagine this, even though he knew the procurator very well. Then the procurator's hoarse and cracked voice was heard saying in Latin, "Untie his hands." One of the legionaries in the escort tapped his spear, handed it to someone else, and went over and removed the prisoner's bonds. The secretary picked up the scroll, decided not to write anything down for the time being, and not to be surprised at anything. "Tell the truth," said Pilate, softly in Greek. "Are you a great physician?"
"No, procurator, I am not a physician," answered the prisoner, rubbing his mangled, swollen, reddened wrists with pleasure. Pilate looked probingly at the prisoner from beneath his brows, and his eyes, no longer dull, gave off their familiar sparkle.
"I did not ask you before," said Pilate, "but do you perhaps know Latin, too?"
"Yes, I do," answered the prisoner. Pilate's yellowish cheeks filled with color, and he asked in Latin,
"How did you know that I wanted to call my dog?"
"That was very simple," replied the prisoner in Latin. "You waved your hand in the air." The prisoner repeated Pilate's gesture. "As if you were petting something, and your lips..."
"Yes," said Pilate.
They were both silent for a while. Then Pilate asked in Greek, "And so, you are a physician?" "No, no," was the prisoner's animated reply. "Believe me, I am not a physician."
"Well, all right, if you wish to keep it secret, you may do so. It has no direct bearing on the case. So you maintain that you did not incite them to tear down or burn or in any other manner destroy the temple?"
"I repeat, Hegemon, I did not incite them to any such actions. Do I look like an imbecile?"
"Oh, no. You do not look like an imbecile," replied the procurator softly, breaking out in a fearsome smile. "So swear that you did nothing of that kind."
"What would you have me swear by?" asked the unbound prisoner excitedly.
"Well, by your life," answered the procurator. "It is most timely that you swear by your life, since it is hanging by a thread. Understand that?"
"You do not think, do you, Hegemon, that you hung it there?" asked the prisoner. "If you do, you are very much mistaken."
Pilate shuddered and answered through his teeth,
"I can cut that thread."
"You are mistaken about that, too," retorted the prisoner, smiling brightly and shielding himself from the sun with his hand. "Don't you agree that that thread can only be cut by the one who hung it?"
"Yes, yes," said Pilate, smiling. "Now I have no doubt that the idle gawkers of Yerushalayim followed at your heels. I do not know who hung up your tongue, but he did a good job. By the way, tell me, is it true that you entered Yerushalayim through the Shushan gate astride a donkey and accompanied by rabble who shouted their welcome to you as if you were some kind of prophet?"
Here the procurator pointed to the scroll of parchment. The prisoner looked uncomprehendingly at the procurator.
"I have no donkey, Hegemon," he said. "I did enter Yerushalayim through the Shushan gate, but on foot, and accompanied only by Levi Matvei, and no one shouted to me, since no one in Yerushalayim knew me then."
"Don't you know these people?" continued Pilate, keeping his eyes fixed on the prisoner. "A certain Dismas, Gestas, and Baraban?"
"I do not know those good people," answered the prisoner.
"Is that the truth?"
"Yes, it is."
"And now tell me, why do you keep using the words good people? Do you call everyone that?"
"Yes, everyone," replied the prisoner. "There are no evil people in the world."
"That is the first time I have heard that," said Pilate with a laugh. "But maybe I know little of life." "You don't have to write down any more," he said to the secretary, although the latter had not been writing anything down, and then he continued speaking to the prisoner. "Did you read that in some Greek book?"
"No, I came to that conclusion on my own."
"And that is what you preach?"
"Yes."
"But what about the centurion Mark, whom they call Rat-Killer? Is he a good man?"
"Yes, he is," answered the prisoner. "But he's an unhappy man. Ever since good people disfigured him, he's been cruel and hard. I'm curious to know who mutilated him."
"I'll gladly tell you," retorted Pilate, "because I was a witness. Good people attacked him the way dogs attack bears. The Germans grabbed him by his neck, arms, and legs. An infantry maniple had been ambushed, and if the cavalry turma under my command had not broken through from the flank, then you, philosopher, would not have had to talk with Rat-Killer. It happened in the Battle of Edistavaiso, in the Valley of the Maidens."
"If I could just talk to him," interjected the prisoner wistfully, "I'm sure he would change drastically."
"I imagine," rejoined Pilate, "that the legate of the legion would have little cause to rejoice if you took it into your head to talk to one of his officers or soldiers. Fortunately for all of us, however, that will not happen, and I'm the one who will see that it doesn't."
At that moment, a swallow darted into the colonnade, flew in a circle under the gilded ceiling, swooped down, its pointed wing almost grazing the face of one of the bronze statues in the niche, and then took cover behind the capital of the column. Perhaps it had decided to build a nest there. During the swallow's